This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Let me introduce Dr. Goldman. She is one of my colleagues and is a wonderful lecturer. She has a special interest in gynecological care for breast cancer, and she's talking today on breast cancer screening.
Thanks, Jeanette, and hopefully this will be interesting in that you'll learn something tonight. Just out of curiosity, I always try to get a sense, how many people have either had personal experience with breast cancer or know someone personally who has had breast cancer, someone who's been close to you? Yeah, so pretty much everyone. And I talk about this because this is such a common disease, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how common. And lots of people have opinions on what should be done, how should we get mammograms, how often to get mammograms, should we do breast exams, should you do self-breast exams. And I think it can be really confusing both for patients as well as even for clinicians. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about is from a clinician's perspective and what we should be doing. So just a little bit about breast cancer epidemiology as it relates specifically to screening for breast cancer. Breast cancer is incredibly common. Approximately 12% of women will be diagnosed with breast cancer at some point during their lifetime. It ends up falling out to be about 1 out of 8 women get breast cancer by age 85. That doesn't mean at your ages now, if you're less than 85, that your risk is 1 in 8. But the lifetime risk is 1 in 8. The number of new cases of breast cancer is approximately 124 per 100,000 women each year. 14% of all new cancers are actually breast cancer. 12% are diagnosed in the reproductive years. And in California alone, we have more than 25,000 cases per year. So what are the clinical concerns when it comes to breast cancer? First is, what are the risk factors for breast cancer? Who should we be screening? And then what should we do for screening? What type of screening should be done? And who should we be offering preventative drugs or preventative surgeries? And hopefully by the end of this, you'll have a better handle on all of that. So the first part I want to talk about is the risk factors for breast cancer. So the biggest risk factor is being a woman and aging. So we know the risk increases as we get older. As I mentioned, risk continues up until about age 85, and at age 85, the risk is 1 in 8. Female gender, we do see breast cancer in males, but it is certainly 99% of the time is in females. Race and ethnicity, we see the highest incidence of breast cancer in Caucasians, but the highest mortality rate in African Americans. Then we know that there are a number of benign types of breast disease that increase someone's risk of getting breast cancer. And these are primarily things that have atypical changes associated with them. So atypical ductal hyperplasia, or ADH, atypical lobular hyperplasia, or ALH, or a proliferative breast lesion. Now, most of those lesions are things that would have been picked up on a mammogram. So someone had an abnormal mammogram, they get a workup that includes a biopsy, and the biopsy shows one of these lesions that are not cancer, but a risk factor for cancer. And the relative risks for cancer varies depending on what type of lesion. But with some of the atypical lesions, people can have a 5-fold or a 6-fold increase, sometimes 7-fold increase risk for breast cancer. Now, we know I'm highlighting in yellow some of the biggest risk factors. So we know that family history and genetic factors are certainly a very large risk factor for breast cancer. And approximately 15 to 20% of women with breast cancer are reported to have breast cancer in a first-degree relative, either a mom or a sister. If you've previously had breast cancer, that's a risk factor for getting breast cancer again. And if you've been exposed to prior ionizing radiation, so, for example, people who had lymphoma and had mantle cell radiation, or sometimes radiation for thyroid disease least that was done way in the past, those can be risk factors for breast cancer subsequent in life. There are lifestyle and dietary factors that are thought to be risk factors for cancer. So a number of lifestyle factors that are thought to increase risk, obesity, and probably the mechanism with that has to do with increased circulating levels of estrogen in women who are heavy, smoking, high fat intake, red meat, alcohol use, people who eat soy phytoestrogens in very high quantities. These have all, there have been lots of studies that have looked at whether these increase risks. None of these increase risks as much as something like atypical ductal hyperplasia or atypical lobular hyperplasia. But these are soft risk factors, and I'm going to talk mainly about alcohol because that gets a lot of press. Things that may be protective, regular exercise. We know for women who have had cancer, we tell them if they, particularly for hormone-positive disease, if they exercise regularly, that that decreases risk of recurrence. Less clear about women who exercise regularly, whether that decreases their risk of ever getting breast cancer, but there's some thought that it may be protective. The benefits may not be seen if women stop exercising with time. Vitamin D is sort of one of the vitamins du jour these days. It's thought to be an important cellular regulator, and there were some studies for women who had breast cancer that said for women with breast cancer who have low levels of D, they may be at higher risk for recurrence compared to women with normal levels of D. That doesn't necessarily correlate that if you have low levels of D, you're at higher risk for getting breast cancer in the first place, and there's really conflicting data that's looked at that. So the alcohol is the one I want to focus on. So why would alcohol use be associated with breast cancer? So first of all, one of the things to realize is that two-thirds of breast cancers are hormone positive. What that means is they're either sensitive to estrogen or progesterone, and that hormonal drugs will be used to modify the tumor environment. So most cancers are hormone positive, and alcohol increases the risk primarily of hormone positive disease. Some of the reasons are thought to be that alcohol can affect the way estrogen is metabolized, and it can increase blood levels of estrogen, which may be a risk factor. Women who have 2 to 5 drinks per day are thought to have about a 1.5-fold risk, increased risk of developing breast cancer compared to non-drinkers. One of the other mechanisms is that alcohol can reduce blood levels of the vitamin folic acid, which is involved in copying and repairing the DNA of our cells. And low levels of folic acid may make it more likely that DNA is incorrectly copied when cells divide, which can cause errors that may lead to subsequent development of cancer. So these are the thoughts as to why alcohol may be associated with a higher risk of hormone-positive breast cancers. Then there are reproductive and hormonal factors. So we see an increased risk of breast cancer with longer estrogen exposure in life. So early menarche, so people who start, young girls who start their periods at an earlier age, and then late menopause, women who finish menopause or go through menopause at a late age. The average age of menopause is 50-51. Women who have a late age of their first child, we typically think of that as older than 35 or don't have children at all, and that's because they're not interrupting the hormonal cycle that happens each month, so they have greater levels of estrogen exposure. Increased breast density, I'm going to talk about that. So that's increases in the glandular elements of the breast. I'll mention a lot more about that later on, but we now know that that is a risk factor for breast cancer. Long-term hormone replacement therapy, lots and lots of controversy and lots of studies. The Women's Health Initiative, which was sort of the big gold standard study that came out in 2002, looked at this. And basically, we know that long-term hormone use is associated with an increased risk, a slight increased risk of breast cancer. Question endogenous levels. So there is some thought that people who have higher circulating levels of hormones within their body, particularly higher estrogen levels, may have higher risks for breast cancer. There have been studies that have questioned whether women who've had a prior abortion have any increased risk. There is no association with prior abortion. Decreased risk. We know that breastfeeding is protective for breast cancer. And I put here question estrogen replacement therapy. So when you look at the studies that looked at hormone replacement therapy, there's two ways that people take hormone replacement therapy. If women have a uterus, they take estrogen and progesterone because progesterone is used to protect the uterus from uterine cancer. If they don't have a uterus, they take estrogen alone. And in the studies that have looked at breast cancer risks, interestingly, we haven't seen an increased risk with estrogen alone. So there's some question whether unopposed estrogen or estrogen without progesterone may be protective for the breast. Again, a very, very controversial area and certainly an area that needs more research. Factors that may increase risk with not clear data, but environmental exposures like PCBs, hair dyes, the data has really been conflicting and no clear evidence. Nighttime light exposure. So they've looked at people who work at night, and exposure to light at night suppresses nocturnal production of the hormone melatonin. And melatonin is thought to have antioxidant effects, and that prevents damage to cells. So they think that people who work at night, because they have lower productions of melatonin, that could be a risk factor for breast cancer and other cancers as well. Factors that have been raised, I sort of wanted to talk about all the things you ever hear in the news that's been raised as a possible association with breast cancer. No association found with antibiotic use, with caffeine, so drink your coffee if you want, antiperspirants, bras, or breast implants. Factors that are thought to be protective. A couple recent studies looked at non-steroidal drugs like ibuprofen and aspirin, and a couple recent studies that were published last year showed a protective effect mainly in obese women. No one knows exactly why, but these drugs have anti-inflammatory effects, and it's thought that the anti-inflammatory effects may be beneficial to cells and may be protective for breast cancer. A few years ago, there was a thought that some of the drugs that are used to treat bone loss and osteoporosis, the bisphosphonates, drugs like Fosamax or Actonel, may be protective for breast cancer. Part of that interest, though, came from some observational studies in women who had breast cancer who were on these aromatase inhibitors. And aromatase inhibitors are used to treat hormone-positive breast cancer, and those drugs have negative effects on the bone. They can cause increased risk of fractures. So finally, in the past year, there was a good study that was published that was a randomized control trial, a very well-designed trial that looked at women who had osteoporosis but no breast cancer, and they showed no reduction in risk in getting breast cancer. So we no longer think that these drugs like Fosamax or Actimel are protective for breast cancer. Okay, so moving from risk factors to issues pertaining to screening. So the questions are, should all women be screened? What age should you begin screening? Should screening stop at older ages? And should screening differ based on if you have different risk factors? And then what method of screening should be done? So the first I want to talk about is who does self-breast exams or have been taught to do self-breast exams. So in the past, everyone was being taught to do self-breast exam. And the American Cancer Society and ACOG is the American College of OBGYN still do recommend teaching self-breast exams. But there's a lot of other organizations that don't. So the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force basically brings together experts in a field to study the literature and make recommendations. And they basically said there's not enough evidence to support women doing regular self-breast exam. When you look at the studies, There aren't really good quality studies. There have been few randomized control trials, which we think of as the best evidence to really help answer a question. The largest review, these Cochrane reviews published these very large, well-designed reviews, and that was from 2003, and they showed no benefit in women dying from breast cancer and more biopsies done for benign disease. There were a couple case-controlled studies that showed less advanced disease if women were taught appropriate self-breast exam. What I do is I tell people, I certainly teach self-breast exams. I have a very biased population because my specialty is women who are at risk for breast cancer. But if I have patients who say, you know, I'm freaked out by touching my breasts, everything feels lumpy, I will tell them, look, it's a controversial area. As long as you're coming in, I'm going to talk about clinical breast exams. I think it's okay if you don't do your self-breast exams. Don't worry that you're doing yourself harm. Clinical breast exam. So clinical breast exam, coming into a provider who is trained and having them do a breast exam. So the American Cancer Society and most U.S. organizations recommend that women get clinical breast exams every 3 years, starting at the ages of 20. So every 3 years between the ages of 20 to 39, and every year after that. The U.S. Preventive Task Force and the World Health Organization says there's not enough evidence to support regular clinical breast exam. So why is that? Well, the evidence isn't clear. Part of that is most of the studies that look at clinical breast exam combine that with mammography. So the independent effects of each of those are less clear. There's also less standardization. Not all clinicians do an exam, and I'm sure as patients you can probably attest to that. Not all clinicians do an exam in the same way. And so there's less standardization for clinical breast exam as opposed to mammography. In 2009, there was a very large review that found no clear benefit. I would say that most clinical exams or women's health exams do include, and we are still teaching to our medical students and our residents, clinical breast exams as part of a routine well woman exam. Mammograms. So what is all the controversy over mammogram? We know that mammograms clearly detect early stage breast cancer. The controversy is whether it improves breast cancer mortality, meaning are we overdiagnosing early breast cancers that, if left alone, would never have progressed to anything clinical or anything that would be harmful to someone's life. So there have been a number of reviews and literature that has looked at this question. In 2009, there was a review that showed decreased mortality in all age groups that are getting mammograms. A 2012 review of only good quality studies, of only randomized control trials, showed decreased mortality, but some of the problems with these studies is they were looking at data from the past where we didn't have as good treatments. So some of the treatments for breast cancer weren't as good, and so they were saying that more of the benefits were based on mammograms, and now some of the effects on mortality are probably based on all the better treatments that we have for breast cancer. Still, when you look at most of the international trials that have looked at this question, most international trials have shown reduced mortality by getting regular mammogram screening. And currently, the American Cancer Society is in the process. They are reviewing literature, and they are expected to come out with new recommendations as to mammogram screenings. So, what do clinicians do, and what should they do? American Cancer Society, American College of OBGYN, and many other organizations say regular mammograms should be done every 1 to 2 years, beginning at age 40. The U.S. Service Preventive Task Force, again, a group of experts that came together, reviewed all of the available literature, and came out with recommendations. They state, and other organizations as well, state that in low-risk women, so I'm going to talk about what's high-risk. So we talked about some of the risk factors by having prior biopsies that showed atypical change or strong family history or dense breast. But in low-risk women who don't have significant risk factors, that you can wait and begin screening at age 50. The World Health Organization recommends not every year, but every 2 years for women between the ages of 50 to 69. So why every 2 years versus every year? Well, it turns out that if you do mammograms every 2 years, it's thought to decrease the number of false positives. So decrease the number of times that women are being called back for things that turn out to be nothing, but they end up undergoing a biopsy that causes anxiety and is a painful test. And if you look at, on a population basis, going to every 2 years does not change overall mortality from breast cancer. Now, how about, that's when to begin getting mammograms, and how often, what about should we stop mammograms at older ages? There's a lot of controversy about this because many cancers in women over the age of 80 are slow growing, and women are unlikely to die from breast cancer as there's other competing causes of death, like heart disease, strokes, things like that. The U.S. Preventive Task Force states that there's no benefit for screening above age 74. The American College of Radiology says continue screening until life expectancy is less than 5 to 7 years on the basis of age or other comorbidities that someone may have. And other groups make no recommendations. What I personally do is I think we should individualize. If I have a healthy 80-year-old who doesn't have a lot of other comorbidities, other health problems, I will still get mammogram screening, but I will talk to them and explain this is why the controversies exist. So I think in general, one of the main points I want you to take away from tonight is we should be doing a lot more individualization in general. Okay, what about breast MRI? This gets a lot of press. So what is a breast MRI? Basically, MRI creates images of the breasts by measuring changes in the movement of protons in fat and water with changing magnetic fields. And then an image is created based on the differences in the tissue relaxation within the breasts that occurs after they apply these pulses of energy. In order to do an MRI, it requires IV gadolinium, so it requires IV contrast. And its use is based on the fact that tumors have new increased blood supply, what's called neovascularity, that takes up the gadolinium, and it releases it quickly, and that leads to this very specific pattern of rapid enhancement and washout. So what that looks like is this. This is a picture of an invasive ductal cancer on a kinetic color map over on this side. So, should we be using breast MRI to screen all women for breast cancer? It turns out this is a very, very sensitive test for detecting small invasive cancers, particularly in high-risk women. It's less specific than mammograms, but it is very, very sensitive. And there's some suggestion in high-risk women that there is improved mortality by doing MRIs. There is no data currently that exists that says there's a benefit to doing screening MRIs in women who are of average risk. And the biggest, biggest reason is there is huge false positives. So nationally, as high as 40%, even at UCSF, where we do lots and lots of MRIs and really have very high qualified mammographers and radiologists, we have as high as a 20% false positive rate. So 1 out of 5 people coming in for tests that make them anxious, they're painful, where they do core biopsies. They do these multiple cores, and then they're painful procedures, and then maybe it may cause scarring, which make breast exams more difficult. So there's a downside of just doing a test when there's a really high false positive, not to mention the cost, about $1,000, so it's about 10 times higher than what a mammogram costs. So who should get MRIs for right now? The American Cancer Society recommends annual MRIs in the following high-risk groups. Women who have, I'm going to talk about genetic mutations, but women who have genetic mutations that increase their risk substantially for breast cancer. So primarily those are people with the BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. Women who have a first-degree relative with one of those mutations, even if they themselves have not been tested. Women who have had prior radiation therapy to the chest when they were between the ages of 10 to 30, so particularly when breast development was happening. These are all a whole bunch of other genetic syndromes that can increase the risk of breast cancer. And then I highlight in yellow, women with an approximate lifetime risk of breast cancer that is at least 20 to 25% according to risk prediction models that utilize family history. So there's a whole bunch of different models that exist that can predict what someone's risk of getting breast cancer is. You can get these online. One's called the Gale risk model. There's a whole BRCA Pro. There's a whole bunch of different models. But most of these are using family history. So if someone has a very strong family history, what I do clinically is if they have very dense breasts, I'm going to talk about dense breasts, but dense breasts and a very strong family history, I'll recommend typically a baseline MRI. But that is not uniform. There are no clear-cut guidelines. I think some of the problems for screening is there's no standard guidelines for clinicians nowadays, and partly because large guiding organizations say different things. I think there's a lot of individual variation between clinicians as to whether they're telling patients to do self-breast exams. I do think, as I mentioned, that clinical breast exams are typically done as part of a well-woman exam. I think most clinicians are still recommending screening mammograms somewhere, if not at 40. If they're going by the U.S. Preventive Task Force, they're saying wait till 50, and they're doing it every 1 year, every 2 year. I think the frequency varies. And I think more and more clinicians are starting to order a screening MRI if they have someone who's very high risk based on family history. Okay. Now I wanted to talk about some of the newer technologies, because there's a lot of new things out there that hit the press almost every day, and it's hard to know. We have our patients come in with stacks of information of what do I do about this? Should I be getting a breast tomo, or what about thermography? So I want to first talk about, who's heard of tomosynthesis? Anybody 3D mammograms? Okay, so 3D mammograms are out there. What this does is it's a modification of digital mammography that uses a moving X-ray source and a digital detector to create a 3D view. The way to think about it is the rays go like this, so they arc differently. It is currently FDA approved as an adjunct to mammography, and it's thought to decrease the number of women being called in for things that turn out to be false positives. So one of the things that women frequently get called back for is what's called superimposition, where the breast tissue is overlying on top of itself. And tomo is thought to be very good at distinguishing a true mass from breast superimposition. And this is a picture of a digital breast tomosynthesis. So it looks even different than a typical mammogram, if you've seen a mammogram photo before. Now, studies to date comparing digital mammogram alone versus digital mammogram plus a tomo found that there is a improved positive predictive value, so an improved likelihood of diagnosing cancer and lower recall rates. It is particularly thought to be useful for dense breasts and high-risk women. Now, what's some of the problems? Well, the way tomo was done, it was exposing people with the older techniques to twice the radiation exposure, so that's a bad thing. But the newer techniques create a 2D image from a 3D tomo image, and it lowers the radiation dose to just above a standard mammogram. But upgrading to that is costly, so many facilities don't offer it, and there are issues related to insurance reimbursement. I can tell you UC is just getting the upgraded tomo. It's not available now and is thought possibly by the summer. CPMC does have breast tomo. I don't know if it's the newer techniques with less radiation or the older techniques, but there's scattered places where you can get breast tomo. I would say to you, the biggest issue is there is no prospective data looking at patient outcomes yet. So this is not something that I think everyone should be just jumping in asking their clinicians for a breast tomo. How about whole breast ultrasound? This is very useful for people who have dense breast tissue, but there's also a lot of false positives associated with ultrasound. If you look at ultrasound plus doing a mammogram, that's thought to slightly improve cancer detection, but it has not been shown to affect breast cancer mortality. And there's no good quality randomized control trials that are comparing screening ultrasound plus mammo versus mammo alone. And it's also very operator dependent. Okay? Now, there is an automated device. So it's an automated device that was FDA approved in 2012 as an adjunct to mammography for asymptomatic women with dense breasts and a negative mammogram, but there's no published data from a screening trial using this device. And when I speak to my radiology colleagues, they feel like there's not enough evidence to support this device. I think some of the problems with people who are getting ultrasounds are there are centers, including in the Bay Area, that when women come in to get their mammograms, they get a mammogram and a whole breast ultrasound. At UCSF, we do targeted ultrasound. So we do ultrasound based on the main thought is that ultrasound is useful if a density is found, whether it's palpated or on a mammogram, of an ultrasound is useful for determining if that density is solid or cystic. Solid masses need to be evaluated further, and cysts are always benign. So we only do targeted ultrasound for specific findings, but there are places that do whole breast ultrasound, and women change insurance a lot. So I find it's difficult as a clinician when a woman comes up and says to me, well, how come you're not ordering my ultrasound this year? Because when I had my care at X, Y, and Z, I had a mammogram plus ultrasound, and there aren't good guidelines. So that's also another problem. Okay, who's heard of thermography? Anybody? So what should we do when patients ask about this? So thermography was developed based on the observation that patients have elevated breast skin temperatures over their breast cancers. And it received FDA approval in 2004 based on the safety of infrared imaging technology, but not on the efficacy of the test. There's lots of independent thermography centers that exist. There are some in the Bay Area. It is not very specific, and there are no studies that have shown this to be an effective screening tool for breast cancer. So it doesn't expose you to radiation, but there are no studies that show this is an effective screening tool. There is not a major organization that has made screening recommendations for thermography. And in 2011, the FDA issued a safety communication saying thermography is not a replacement for screening mammogram and on its own is not an effective screening tool. And what I find is difficult is when a patient comes in and brings me her abnormal thermogram, but I order a mammogram and it's normal. We don't know what to do in that situation. Okay. Anybody hear of this California Dense Breast Notification Legislature? There are a number of states in the country that are starting to pass this, but this was a reporting law that took effect in April of 2013 that mandates written notification to women after screening mammography regarding their tissue density and the need to discuss screening option with their primary care physicians or whoever ordered those tests. There are four levels of density. Level one is mainly fat. Level two is scattered areas of density. Level three is heterogeneously dense. And level four is extremely dense. And it turns out about 50% of women who get a mammogram are classified as in level three or level four. But this is thought to allow for individualized risk-based approach for decision-making. So the problems with this legislation is women are asking what this means, and primary care physicians and OBGYNs and nurse practitioners should be able to answer these questions with evidence-based information that offers guidance, but many clinicians don't know enough. And information should be easily available to all clinicians ordering these screening mammograms. Turns out there's excellent guidance on this website called Breast Density Info. I just throw this out there. Maybe that should go along with every report so people can look up that information on a website. Or maybe the conversation should begin with radiology. So there was a lot of controversy and there was lobbying against this bill because people felt like this was coming out, but no one knows what to do with the information. So if you are in the extremely dense category, does that mean you should get an MRI? And if you get an MRI, how often? Should you get a breast tomosynthesis? Should you be coming in for clinical breast exams more often? There are no clear national guidelines that say what to do in those. And so until we have data really good randomized controlled trials that look at some of these newer modalities in the screening setting, I think it's difficult to put out information like this. So this was just an interesting test I did. We are very evidence-based at UCSF, and I like to think that all of us in our division, certainly we're reading the literature very regularly. And so I did a little quiz to all of the faculty in the gynecology division just to say, just to ask them these questions. Do you know what breast tomo is? Do you know when you'd ever order it? Do you know when to order a breast MRI for screening? And have you ever heard of the California Dense Breast Notification Legislature? Only one faculty member had ever heard of breast tomo. No one knew when to order it. Half knew when to get a screening MRI. Most had heard of dense breast legislation, and the comments were, would be helpful to get guidelines. So that's in an academic institution. So I tell you this just to say, I think you're going to see a lot of things changing. There's going to be a lot more individualization, but there are not clear-cut guidelines with all of these new tests that are out there. And I tell people, don't just jump on the bandwagon and ask your clinicians, I want to have a breast tomo, I want to have an MRI, unless you understand some of the issues surrounding the use of these tests in the screening setting. People talk about, what about risk stratification based on genetic profiling? So that's doing personal DNA analysis that provides insight into what someone's risk is for getting certain diseases like cancer. And there's lots of companies out there that are starting to offer genetic profiling, and the costs are typically about $2,000. And it's thought that these tests might provide reassurance or enable people to take preventative action. The problem is that some of these tests are unreliable and may be difficult to interpret, and they may lead to further unnecessary testing, a lot of inside personal distress, and I think there's a lot of ethical issues still around these. I think, but this is the future. This is going to allow for better utilization of resources, more tailored care, but I don't think we're there quite yet. What about from all of your perspectives? So when we see patients, I would say most patients overestimate their risk of getting breast cancer. And that's because, as I asked you in the beginning, everyone knows someone who's had breast cancer. We get lots of questions from patients regarding mammograms and how often to do them. We get lots of questions regarding what should I do because my report came back with dense breasts. I would say my impression is that most patients still believe in mammogram screening. And I think that one of the things that I find is as more of these information about these new technologies hit the press and internet, that we're getting lots and lots of questions of what to do, and we don't always know the answer. Okay, in the last part of the talk, I want to talk about prevention of breast cancer. Who even knew there are drugs that are FDA approved to prevent breast cancer? Okay, so there are drugs, tamoxifen, raloxifene, aromatase inhibitors. I'm going to talk about those. And then there are preventative surgeries. So who should we be considering giving, doing more for prevention? Basically based on risk. So if someone is really high risk, so high risk based on family history, particularly if they have first-degree relatives that are diagnosed at early ages in the premenopausal years or multiple family members with breast cancer, there are models, as I talked about, like the Gale risk model. That's just one of many that can help identify what someone's risk is. If there are concerns that someone may carry a genetic mutation, has one of these hereditary breast ovarian cancer syndromes, I'm going to talk about that. Or if someone had a prior biopsy that showed atypia, atypical ductal hyperplasia, atypical lobular hyperplasia, those are people, even ductal carcinoma in situ, those are people that we consider giving preventative drugs. So how much breast and ovarian cancer is hereditary? It turns out most is not. So 75% just happen. About 10 to 15% is something that runs in the family, and of that, 5 to 10% is due to known gene mutations. Now, the most common of these genetic mutations are these BRCA gene mutations. When someone has a mutation in those genes, it increases their lifetime risk of both breast and ovarian. Normally, breast and ovarian have nothing to do with each other, but when someone carries these gene mutations, it increases the risk of both, and no one knows why. No one knows why specifically those. You can see early prostate in men, with BRCA2, you can see melanoma, but you really worry about breast and ovarian for women. When should you think about hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome? If breast cancer is diagnosed before age 50, two or more relatives who've had breast cancer, any male in the family with breast cancer, if someone has bilateral breast cancer, it is uncommon for one person to get two different cancers. So if they have bilateral breast cancer or two different cancers in the same breast, women who've had breast cancer who are of Ashkenazi Jewish descent or Eastern European Jewish ancestry. Now, basically, we have now learned about these gene mutations in any isolated, geographically isolated group, not just people of Jewish ancestry. It was studied first in people of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, but we are seeing other pockets around the world where people have been geographically isolated and probably had some inbreeding where we are seeing these mutations. If you see even one ovarian cancer, it is reasonable to test. The reason for that, as I mentioned, one out of eight women get breast cancer. If we live to be 85, the lifetime risk of ovarian is one in 73. It is so much rarer that one cancer warrants testing. These are the risks. So the lifetime risks are much, much higher if you have BRCA1 or BRCA2 compared to the general population. And so there's a consensus that those patients should have increased surveillance starting at the age of 25 to 30. Breast surveillance consists of a breast exam typically every 6 to 12 months, and annual imaging that alternates between MRI and mammograms. So in these high-risk groups, we basically say, we understand that breast MRIs have a lot of high false positives, and we do it anyways. We talk to these patients about prevention with tamoxifen and raloxifene, and we consider doing prophylactic surgeries like bilateral mastectomies. So, tamoxifen. It's in this drug called SERM, Selective Estrogen Receptor Modulators. And in English, what that means is it acts like estrogen in some tissue and unlike estrogen in other tissue. Interestingly, it was originally thought to be a contraceptive, and then they found that, A, it induced ovulation, so it's a bad contraceptive if it makes you ovulate. But at the same time, they found it suppressed mammary tumors in rats, and that led to the research looking at it as a potential breast cancer drug. And by 1992, it was shown to increase disease-free interval and decrease women getting breast cancer on the other side in both pre- and postmenopausal women. There was a very large breast cancer prevention trial done in this country that showed 5 years of tamoxifen and high-risk women decreased their risk of getting hormone-positive breast cancer by 45%. So if you were told you had a 20% chance of getting breast cancer in the next 10 years, 5 years of tamoxifen cuts that close to in half. It is a very effective drug. It was actually approved in 1998 for prevention. In 2013, U.S. Preventive Service Task Force did this big meta-analysis of large prevention trials, and they showed basically there is a overall 30% reduction in the risk of hormone-positive breast cancer in tamoxifen users versus a placebo. So I tell people somewhere between 30 to 50, very, very effective drug. It is currently recommended for use in pre- and postmenopausal women who are at higher risk for breast cancer. There's also non-cancer benefits. In this large meta-analysis that was published, they found lower risks of vertebral fractures. So tamoxifen is like estrogen at the bones. It's good for your bones. Estrogen is good for your bones, and tamoxifen can prevent fractures. So why don't more people use it? Basically, there's a fear of side effects, and there's reports that tamoxifen can increase the risk of uterine cancer. It's pretty rare, and I'm going to talk about it. But lots of people get hot flashes, vaginal discharge, dryness, weight gain. Older reports said up to 60% of women experience negative side effects, and as many as 20 to 40% say, I'm going to stop this drug because of that. Interestingly, however, there were two studies that looked at quality of life in very well-controlled trials, in large prevention trials, and they did not see significant effects of tamoxifen compared to a placebo drug in depression, anxiety, major psychosocial outcomes, or any quality of life. So basically, I think it gets a lot of bad rap. So what are some of the adverse effects? Tamoxifen is estrogenic and anti-estrogenic, and any estrogenic drug can increase the risk of blood clots. So there's a 2 to 3-fold increased risk of blood clots. In studies, there were non-significant increased risks for stroke, and so both arterial and venous blood clots. And most recommendations are if you're on tamoxifen and you need to have surgery, stop tamoxifen for a few days before surgery, as well as stopping it before you go on a long trip. Now, some of the biologic effects. As I said, it acts both like estrogen and unlike estrogen, and the effects vary depending on the environment. So it varies depending if you're premenopausal and have estrogen being produced, or if you're postmenopausal and don't. In premenopausal women, tamoxifen actually stimulates the ovaries to produce estrogen, and they use it as a fertility drug. It stimulates the ovaries to produce estrogen, and so it can stimulate ovarian cysts. It can cause a lot of menstrual irregularities. It can cause benign polyps. It can make fibroids grow, endometriosis. Has a lot of stimulatory effects. But the big thing is it's not thought to increase the risk of cancer in premenopausal women. Postmenopausal women who don't have estrogen being produced, they're the ones that you see the cancers. Now, the risks for cancer are really not that large. The relative risks are about anywhere from 1.3 to 7.5-fold. They do increase the longer someone's on it. What does this really mean in absolute numbers, though? Because that's what you care about. What I tell people is, on average, there's about 4 cases of uterine cancer per 1,000 women taking tamoxifen each year. They almost always present with bleeding, which is in the same way any other uterine cancer presents. The risks are thought to stop when someone stops tamoxifen, and once someone's 5 years off tamoxifen, the risks are thought to be back down to baseline. And I tell people that clearly I think most women get a much greater benefit to their breasts than they do risk to their uterus. This question comes up a lot. If tamoxifen causes all these changes of the lining of the uterus, should I get ultrasounds to evaluate my uterus? And the bottom line is no. And that's because there's a lot of changes that will make the ultrasound look funny. So there's this irregular thickness, irregular echoes. But if we take someone to the operating room and do a D&C and look at the tissue, it doesn't go along with what the ultrasound said. And that's because tamoxifen causes enlargement of these glands. And so when the radiologists go to measure the thickness, they overcall it. And we don't even know, we have no data on what's a normal thickness for women on tamoxifen. And so without having normal data on what's too thick, what happens is people are referred to us for biopsies or taking people to the operating room for hysteroscopies and D&Cs. So basically there's overtreatment and unnecessary surgeries. And in the worst case, people are even having hysterectomies because their lining's too thick on tamoxifen when we don't have data to support that. And this is actually a picture. Here's the lining of the uterus, and this is the subendometrial gland. And so when the radiologists measure it, sometimes they overcall the thickness. The last two areas are just raloxifene for prevention and the aromatase inhibitor. So raloxifene is also in the same class of drugs as tamoxifen, and it's been FDA approved as a bone drug since 1997. Because it's in the same class of drugs as tamoxifen, in the trials that led to its FDA approval as a bone drug, they looked at how common was breast cancer, and they found it was decreased. So that led to the design of this very large trial called the STAR trial to compare head-to-head tamoxifen versus raloxifene for breast cancer prevention. It was a 5-year trial, one of the largest prevention trials ever done. And basically, the final data came out in 2010, and it showed what we knew about tamoxifen. It reduced the risk of invasive breast cancer and DCIS, non-invasive cancer, by about 50%. And raloxifene was 75% as good as tamoxifen, but had fewer cancers and significantly fewer blood clots, and 78% as good as tamoxifen in preventing against DCIS. And in 2007, raloxifene got FDA approval. This is the drug that's really underutilized. It's good for your bones. It is preventative for uterine cancer, not causing it, doesn't cause as many blood clots, tends to be tolerated better, not quite as good a drug. It's about 75% as good as tamoxifen in preventing cancer, but still a very, very good drug. This was just a summary. And overall, in 7 fair or good quality studies, they found that tamoxifen and raloxifene reduced the incidence of invasive breast cancer by 7 to 9 cases in 1,000 women over 5 years compared to placebo. Neither of the trials have shown a difference in women dying from breast cancer, but the hope is that if we follow people long enough, that we would see, or with larger prevention trials, we would see a benefit. Aromatase inhibitors. So the way that tamoxifen works as a breast cancer drug is it competes with estrogen for the breast cell receptor, and it prevents activation of the breast cell receptor. What aromatase inhibitors do is all women have small levels of male hormones circulating in our bodies. Aromatase inhibitors prevent conversion of male hormones to very weak forms of estrogen. They're not estrogens that you can measure in the lab. They're very weak forms of estrogen. 3 different ones on the market. There was a large clinical trial that showed a 70% reduction in hormone-positive invasive breast cancer with one of these aromatase inhibitors compared to placebo over a 3-year trial. The American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, added this to their updated guidelines in 2013 as a drug that can be used to prevent breast cancer, but it is not yet FDA approved. But those are the 3 drugs that are on the market. So if you use an aromatase inhibitor, what are the adverse side effects? Those drugs have all the bony and joint stuff. Pain, bone pain, joint pain, and bone loss. Also increased cardiovascular risks, but no differences in people actually having heart attacks or heart attack-related deaths. Increased risk of fractures, so think of bone loss and bony and joint side effects during the treatment, but once people stop those drugs, the fractures don't continue. What we see in the office, marked vaginal dryness. These people are more shut down than menopause. They have all of their estrogen shut down in their body, and they have horrific vaginal dryness, painful sex, and decreased libido. What were some of the beneficial effects with these drugs? Fewer strokes in the treatment studies, but that didn't persist after treatment. Lower blood clots. And the one that's most interesting is fewer endometrial cancers. And what I tell patients is these drugs probably lower the risk lower than the general population. So aromatase inhibitors, not only do they not increase the risk, but they prevent uterine cancer. So what are my recommendations for drugs? I think clinicians should review family and personal history to assess the risk for breast cancer. I think if you have high-risk women, that we should be considering tamoxifen in premenopausal women and raloxifene in postmenopausal women. If someone has reasons that they can't take those drugs, like they've had a blood clot, then we should consider an aromatase inhibitor. But I think we should be discussing the side effects with our patients. And I clearly tell patients, don't let your doctors get routine ultrasounds if you are on tamoxifen. Now, in the last few slides, I just want to talk about preventative surgeries. So this is risk-reducing mastectomies, which removes most but not all of the breast tissue. There's what's called skin-sparing procedures, which are more recently developed, and they remove more breast tissue than the traditional subcutaneous mastectomy. And oftentimes it's combined with immediate reconstruction, and it provides a very good cosmetic result. Do they work? Yes. Significantly reduces the risk of breast cancer and death. Studies show in premenopausal women, prophylactic mastectomies decrease the risk of hormone receptor positive breast cancer by 90%. And for women having prophylactic oophorectomies, so if they have their ovaries out before age 40, there's approximately 50% reduction in breast cancer risk. There's other health issues associated with that, but this is just in terms of preventing breast cancer. One of the questions that I get asked, do I need to get a mammogram or some sort of imaging if I've had a bilateral mastectomy? And the answer to that is no. If a complete mastectomy, there's no need for imaging. If it's a skin-sparing, nipple-sparing procedures, some centers may still recommend it, but most do not. And if there's ever a question, some centers will do an MRI to see if there's any residual breast tissue, And then if there's no residual tissue, say absolutely no screening. Here at UC, we do not recommend any screening. Also, when someone has saline or silicone implants, or they have one of these reconstructive procedures like a tram flap or a deep flap, it is not recommended to do any sort of imaging. Okay. Finally, in conclusion, hopefully you understand some of the risk factors for breast cancer and understand some of the controversies and issues surrounding screening from a clinician's perspective. Know that there are drugs that are used for prevention, and understand some of the adverse effects of these drugs. Know what the screening and prevention strategies are if someone's at high risk. And really, one of the take-home messages is that you understand that screening and prevention should be individualized. The days should be long gone of, you're a woman over a certain age, go get a mammogram. And it really should be, let's look at your risk factors as an individual woman and decide what should we be doing for screening and prevention for you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.